So, firstly, a very big thank you to the Sanger Live team, for George for hosting at this period of time that we have together. And as he mentioned to you, we begin with a guided meditation, followed on with a talk for around 30 minutes on the theme, and then finally, question and answers either in the chat form or the spoken word. And just with regard to, let me just send my eye for a moment, to the theme for the evening, I would like to make it a guided meditation combined with a reflection, the two working together. So, initially, let's make our posture rather straight and upright, and the sitting upright with genuine presence. Our 2 feet, if you're in the chair, firmly on the floor. The full length of the spine, chin slightly tucked in, 2 hips just moved forward a little bit, so the whole posture has a certain uprightness to it, a quiet authority, in fact, to it. So the first period of the time is the meditation feature, and then part of the way through we'll shift to the reflection. So the fullness and the richness of just sitting on the chair, sitting on this earth. You may wish to be focused on a primary object, such as the breathing. Or you may wish to just be. Two important elements in this meditation process. One is the stillness of the whole being. We are not thinking about it. Not interpreting, it's a very bare, raw experience of the quality of stillness of being. It is a rather fundamental shift from doing, doing, doing. A primary interruption of the busyness of the mind, the tendency to hurry from one thing to another. We sit. We experience firsthand the stillness of the being. A range, a variety of sensations in our stillness emerge out of the body. Maybe warmth or tingling, pleasant or unpleasant. Coolness in some parts of the body, heat in another part. Our stillness is enabling receptivity to the variety, the diversity of sensations in the biological life, the physical life. Sometimes we wake up in the middle of the night. And we love the stillness of the night. And right now, we can wake up to the stillness of the day, of the morning, afternoon, evening, or night, in whatever time zone you might be. This stillness contributes to the reduction of stress, harmonizing body and mind. For an authentic experiential sense of well-being, through the simple receptivity to this element we call stillness. all the inanimate objects surrounding you, surrounding me. Are a confirmation of stillness. They are still. They can serve to remind us that we rediscover daily the significance, the benefits of stillness. For calm, for inner peace. For renewal. For a shared sense of intimacy with the inanimate world as well as the animate, the sentient world. Things and us as a human being are together in this stillness. And the other element is the silence. Silence contributes to confirming the element of stillness, and the stillness contributes to confirming the silence. And in the recognition of the silence, the voice of the speaker does not have to invade, intrude upon the silence. That the formations of the sound, in a way, traveling through the silence, not getting in the way of the silence. And all of this, these two elements helps to reveal the subtleties that are taking place, the subtleties in the sensations, the subtleties in the world of things, the subtle changes that are going on. And in the quietness of our being, we can engage in reflection. A reflection which is a meditation on change. With three primary ways. One is to witness it. And with our silence and stillness, we can witness at quite refined levels. Breathing, movement of part of the body, change in sensations, changes in what's going on around us, light, sounds coming from the world around. So one important aspect in this world between birth and death is being in touch with the dynamics of change. Whether we're in contact with the silence or not. Being very clear that the dynamics and the process, the evolution, is a confirmation of unfolding change. One thing arising, staying and passing, and giving rise to something else or something similar. Therefore, a reflection would be, do I need to really engage in day-to-day life in the pure, direct witnessing of changes? Changes during the day, changes during the night, changes in the communications, changes in the thought, changes in our experiences. We're not making it up. It's not a fiction of our mind. Birth to death is a constant confirmation of a dynamic, a process of arising, staying, and passing, and a feature of wisdom is being very clear and in tune with it. Do we need more exploration of this? Are we forgetful to remember this? Are we getting out of touch? And the second area, we witness change. We witness what's going on with ourselves or others. Do we need to introduce into that dynamic a problematic situation, to introduce ways to change it. Teachings, Dharma gives great emphasis to this. What are the changes that might be needed in our life at this time? Changes in views, changes to end the suffering, changes needing a fresh way of looking at something. Change which encourages development. So one is direct witnessing of. The second is being very clear. What are the changes, small or major, I need to explore in my life? And not thinking one has to do it all by oneself. This is a social fiction. The sharing with another, the listening to others, the reminders can contribute to insight and inspiration. This is the Sangha of mutual support. And finally, and third, in the dynamics that we live with, we may look at a situation, bring mindfulness and clarity to it, and recognize it's the time to move on, to start something afresh and really new, to keep trust in the adventure of life. So all three areas are important areas for all of us to explore. Witnessing of change, developing change in what's arising and what needs to change, either in ourselves or others, and also the freedom as well to move on to something fresh and new. Quiet final minute together in the silence, in the stillness. May all beings explore change. May all beings find insights into the dynamics of existence. May all beings know the freedom to engage. Thank you for lending an ear. Just going to have a sip of the water. Glasses on the floor here. So this period, 30-minute talk with you, and in the period of time, like to explore this human situation that we are in called the journey, we might say, we might describe it from birth through until death. And in journey of change going on, you and I might look at some of the photographs when we were youngsters, perhaps in a group of kids, we can hardly recognize who we are in that picture. And we go to teens, 20s, 30s, and one keeps moving along with things. One ends up, as you can see, in the white-haired club with the passage of the years there. And it's valuable with regard to all of this to have a general overview, dare I use the word, transcendent view. And what I mean by that is there is the details of our daily life, and that includes our connections and relationships with ourselves and other people. Includes our work and our leisure and much, much more. And the days of our life, in terms of the content for the mind, can kind of fill up, so to speak, our life. And in that, there's a lot of possibly activity going on, or just kind of being with oneself. But there's a limitation to all of this. Both the excess of being too introverted, too much in oneself, or so much involved with outer circumstances, the content, the story of both ends up filling up our life and all the changes which can go on with it. So there is an encouragement, and it's an important one, to have a kind of overview, fancy word is transcendent view. And what is meant by that, a little bit as we did with the guided meditation, to generate an expansive view. And in the expansive view, one way is almost to forget the story of our life, forget all the things we do or we haven't done, and just experience the bareness, stillness of things, stillness of oneself, a certain intimacy, allowing things to rest. And in that allowing, the potential for something fresh and precious and deep, in fact, to emerge. Sometimes our overview of things is just remembering ourselves, this dynamic and process between birth and death, as it were, the two poles in which you and I coexist. And just keeping that in mind, little reflection on that contributes, when done well and skillfully, to a certain modesty of our life, a certain recognition of the foolishness of ego activities like trying to be rich or famous or get a name, because one's got a perspective, that's the overview. Wow, why get lost in all of that? Life is short. The days go by, the decades go by. Let me have a clearer, more expansive view. But it doesn't end there. There's a lovely discourse, lots of them, of the Buddha, and he speaks of undertakings. That means that when you and I start something, and when we start something, whatever it might be about, we don't actually know. And we can't where it will end up. So we undertake, something gets underway, but we don't know where it will go, where it will finish. And In the overview, there is a simple but supportive description to remember. And what's given are four propositions. So I'll give you the four. One is we start something and it's pleasant, we're happy about it. And the passage of time goes by, and beautifully, marvelously, wonderfully, it's still pleasant. And incidentally, the word karma, just for a moment or two here, slight interruption with you, literally means action, but it's relative to actions which have consequences, actions which have certain outcomes. There, not always, but that's a general use. The second is it starts off pleasant. The passage of time goes by and it ends up not as we thought or as we felt in the beginning, and the consequence, the outcome is unpleasant and sometimes extremely painful. The second. And the third is it starts off unpleasant. One still engages in the doing, whatever that may be about. And surprise, surprise, and beautifully and sweetly, it ends up as pleasant. And the fourth one is, you've probably got it by now, it starts off unpleasant, backstroke painful, and it ends up painful. I once mentioned this, I remember years ago, 20, 30 years ago, I can't remember, in one of the retreats, and one person came up to me and said, "Christopher, the fourth one, it starts off painful, it ends up painful, is the story of my life." I went, "Oh dear, oh dear. Please meditate. There has to be some exceptions." So we might think, "Well, Christopher, give me some more example. Honestly, what could be easier than to use the personal relationship?" Then it's really simple. So with the first, it's that I'm talking about intimate relationship now, close relationship, partners, husband and wife. It starts off pleasant, passage of time, some ups and downs, but years later, it's still lovely and sweet. And I had a rather lovely example given to me some years ago. One of the people on the retreat, he said that his parents, who in this time were, I think, in their 40s, 50s, or whatever. And he said, the two of them are still like a couple of teenagers, which I thought was really sweet. And he gave an example of it. He said, he remembers when he was in his teens and he came downstairs for breakfast, and his mum and dad were snogging in the kitchen. And he's look, and he said it was really embarrassing. But afterwards, with a little reflection, he thought, "Well, they're still crazily in love with each other after all these years." That's, so sometimes there are those kind of examples. Now we know the next one, don't we? It starts off pleasant, beautiful, happy. Perhaps you get, I've never been married, it's not my cup of tea, but others of you have. And it starts off pleasant and it's wonderful, and there is a dedication and commitment until death do us part, you'll be lucky, and all of that flows along, and then it all goes for whatever reason. And sometimes the pleasant and the happiness and the joyful ends up very painful. One couldn't have imagined how distressing and painful and sad and sometimes quite traumatized by it, from pleasant to painful. And third one is that it starts off unpleasant. And I've heard this a few times over the years with the relationship here. A person has agreed to get married. Example, agreed to stay with him or with her. But all the voices inside are, it's not for me, she or he's not the right person, and I'm only doing it. I don't know why I'm doing this. I'm sure I'm making a mistake. It's not going to last. And sometimes because it could be one or the other is pregnant, or because need for some security or whatever. It's all rather painful and distressing at the beginning. A lot of uncertainty, a lot of anguish going on. Passage of time goes by, that fades, and one thinks, wow, I made the right choice. We have such a lovely, deep connection. So sometimes it's from the painful to the pleasant. And then, of course, sometimes in relationship, starts off, and it's still going, there, and one is just not happy. Wasn't happy at the beginning, not happy in the middle, and not happy in the end. And that also requires a lot of exploration. We, that's you and me, in these four areas, may we have an overview. What in our life is pleasant and sustains itself? What in our life is pleasant, but it's turned the other way? What in our life started off as difficult, problematic, unpleasant, and actually it's changed to something much more happier and worthwhile? And of course, is there anything painful in our life? It's still continuing. That needs to be looked at. What are the changes I need to make? And once again, might include some sharing with another to find some useful, insightful steps forward. There, this is life. The personal story and the overview, and the potency of the overview is not detachment from it, but it's just a wider perspective. And that wider perspective enables us to look more deeply at situations and say, my goodness me, human beings, we exist on this earth. We're making this journey through the field of existence there. Goodness me, how much of our life, rightly so, is exploring any of these four undertakings? And sometimes, of course, some of them are going on simultaneously. And the point being made here, please reflect. Please look at what's important. Please see what your major undertakings are, what your relationship to, what changes might need to be made, what needs to be developed, what needs to be let go of. So you need in this quite often creative responses. And I said to you in the guided meditation, for goodness sake, don't end up just thinking, oh, I'll just observe it. I'll just watch it. In the last week or two, I and probably yourselves as well, have been reminded of the presence of loved ones in our life, in the Dharma community, in the Sangha, in the network, who have played such a beautiful and precious part in our life, who have, shall we say, come to what I describe as come to the end of the journey, who died. One of them, of course, is the person I call the saint of mindfulness, the lovely, precious, venerable Thich Nhat Hanh, perhaps one of the most remarkable human beings of our living generation there. And his presence, his expansive teachings, his poetry, his beautiful step-by-step activities on the earth have been a source of delight, insight, and encouragement of what a life of wisdom and kindness cooperating together. And as I referred into an obituary on the blog, he embodied what I call soft power in the most beautiful way. And a small example of that, as a peace activist, he and his sangha, or some of the monks and nuns in New York, the incident, I still get the picture of it when I heard about this. There was a protest against the Blair Bush organization and authorization of the massive bombing on the people of Iraq, more than 1,000 bombs dropped on Baghdad alone, in the claim of fake news, of course, of weapons of mass destruction. Complete lies there. And in the 2.5 million people on the walk in New York to the UN building. And Tai, as he does, in his gentle manner, walked very slowly as his sangha with him. People all kept going by, going by, going by. And then they started to walk slowly and mindfully at the same pace. It went much more quiet everywhere. And around 2 million of them just walked. And he found himself at the front of the line. I thought it was just a sweet example of quiet authority and presence in life. And may you and I, in our explorations, learn much from these wonderful and beloved teachers who kind of offered their life in a way to us, the Sangha, and we learn from them, we take things to heart, and we find ways to express. And Thich Nhat Hanh is a marvelous expression of that, and it will always be with us in a deep way. And the second is a very dear friend from Hamburg in Germany, Hans Gruber. Hans and I knew each other for 30 years, and he is a philosopher, Buddhist philosopher in the traditional sense, in which the tradition has given immense encouragement to use our mind. The Buddha's teachings is an encouragement to expand and the heart and use our mind. And my goodness me, Hans had a mind, and he really used it with his cut to the bone essays and articles. There he knew Sanskrit and Pali, these two primary languages, extremely well. And in many exchanges with him, not easy, but I certainly learned a great deal. And lots of points that he mentioned there over in 30 years. And one of them was, he wasn't very happy with the translation of the word sati, S-A-T-I, into the English mindfulness. He really felt, and he's said this plenty of times, it just didn't do the word sati justice. It was mindfulness was too kind of light. And he said a more appropriate use, and one can see it in the teachings of the Buddha, is clear seeing. He said that's what sati is about. It's about clear seeing. It's not just about being mindful of, but it's clear seeing. And in our clear seeing, much discovery can come. And therefore, it's not surprising that the teachings and the regularity of references in the teachings to sati clear seeing, which is I use the word mindfulness. I don't have any aversion around it, but I think the deeper sense of it is a clear seeing, both of the past and the present and the future. In the exploration of this journey as well, from birth to death, we'll just have another sip of the water, if I may. Gosh, I've only got 10 more minutes to go and I'm just warming up here. And sometimes, back to the encouragement with you, liberation, which is the bedrock, the heart and soul of all of these teachings, we do not have to keep thinking of it as the end result, as a consequence. We develop the right karma and now we get the benefit. Not quite in that way in this body of teachings. It sometimes comes across like that with the tradition and in the Theravada tradition. But there are lots of things which I love with the Theravada tradition, but some things I find irritating. For example, the language of here and now gets used regularly enough in the Buddha Dharma, but here and now doesn't appear in the Buddha's teachings. We hear a lot about moment-to-moment meditation, but it doesn't appear moment-to-moment, I haven't found anyway, anywhere in the Buddha's teachings. Yeah. So it's useful and beneficial, but we, rather than being restricting ourselves to moment-to-moment as proper meditation or just being in now, let's consider this transcendent view and coming once again back to that. May you and I regularly in the daily life, just as I said, step back from and have a general overview of our life and what that means, and life itself. And what that means is, do we have enough freedom? This is a signal of what liberation is about now. Find and know enough space to be able to look back, to get our situation into a perspective. That's what the overview does. And I'll just give you a couple of example. Sometimes a person has been in work for a long time, been involved in a particular activity for a long time, been in relationship for a long, long time. And the person hasn't realized how much inwardly the person has gone, this is important, gone for refuge in that. It's become a refuge. It's become a go-to situation. They've gone to. And that which he or she have gone to, and that also could be in religious, spiritual groups as well as anything else, it crashes. It falls apart. It dissolves for all sorts of reasons that it happens. And if a person has gone for refuge in that, with that, and not knowing, that means an ignorance of the ignorance, shall we say, like that. Whoa, suffering is going to be at a high level. High level. Because we have gone for refuge in the unstable, uncertain, unpredictable, unchangeable, and somehow adopted the view, not purposefully, not deliberately, not any kind of clinging to feeling, but we just kind of adopted a view of that's our go-to, that's reliable. Whatever that might be about, it could be health, as I mentioned, it could be relationships, it could be work, and much, much more. Do you know yourself? Have you planted yourself somewhere? Be careful if you have. And the teachings, lots of warnings about it, that we tend to know it. It's very hard to see when we're in the midst of it, because it might be pleasant and lovely and secure, and it's for years, whatever it might be about. But when it does, if it does crash, whoa, the pain, the pain, the pain, the anguish, the anxiety, the heavy burden of separation and loss, the sadness, the grief, whoa, the despair. Oh, whoa, 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 whoa. One had no idea of the investment in that and the outcome, the consequence, the karma and the consequence. So the teachings are a reminder, love, yes, feel connection, yes, but for goodness sake, see clearly. See clearly. And in going for refuge, also not in oneself, because you and I, we're not that reliable as well. So we have a sangha, but it's amorphous. It's generous. It's expansive. And there's many ways to experience a sangha. Many ways. This is one this evening. Keep your heart, mind, ears open for the sangha. It's not fixed. It's not narrowed to a particular viewpoint. It's generous. That's an authentic sangha. And that's worth going for refuge in. And to really know the difference, because if it's gone into that which you like, love, depend on very, very much, oh, be careful. And as I said to one person rather recently, who was shocked to bits, we might say, at the dissolution, this case of the marriage, didn't realize how much dependency, quietly, hardly known to herself, had gone into the relationship and into the marriage. And when it finished, even with mutual consent, the outburst was a shock. And my view of it, perhaps some may consider not a very kind view, but my view of the situation is, sometimes in life, in order to wake up, which is what the teachings are about, it is the shock. It is the drama of the separation. It is the loss. It is the sudden being thrown out of whatever that might be about, which gets us to wake up. And though it's painful and anguish and regret, and the story keeps going on and on, it takes some quiet patience and determination, and to find one's own feet in all of this, stand on one's own 2 feet, have the support of people you love around, the sangha, and out of all of that we can flower. And I would say it's worth going through all that anguish if it's really going to get us to wake up. Otherwise, you could go through life comfortable, and sleepwalk through it. Missed what the teachings of freedom and liberation are about. Yeah. In how are we doing? Oh my gosh, it's like time's gathering. Give me just finishing, promise. With the exploration in these areas, just a short reflection. I've spoken to you about what we initiate, being mindful of the changes and outcomes. Four primary kinds, all for reflection. Spoken to you well about the exploration of change. Sometimes change plus initiating of change in that event, whatever that might be about. Second. And thirdly, it's time to make a change, to move on from, to let go of, start something really new and fresh. And all of these are primary contributions to liberating the being. And then there is the overview, as I just referred to. And that is a freedom to look in the larger picture of things. If you put all that together, beloved Sangha, you'll be fine. And if you forget, storm is on its way. This is life. So take good note of the teachings. Let's just have a quiet minute together, and then I'll say a little bit about the donations and a little bit in the Q&A with you. May all beings explore ways to free up the being. May all beings develop the capacity for seeing clearly, really clearly. May all beings live with wisdom in the face of this field of existence. Thank you. So another sip of the water. When I take a sip of the water, especially with the Zoom meetings, the thought has arisen on more than one occasion. If I had my way, I don't use the supermarkets. I just don't use them. Prefer the local market and the small shopkeepers. But with the supermarkets, who I'd love to see go bankrupt, but it's unlikely to happen. There would be a corner of the supermarket just for junk food, just a little corner of it. So we wouldn't get rid of it, all of it, but just 95%, just in one. And everything else was nutritious, healthy food there. And the primary purchase of liquid would be water. So water would be all over the supermarket, bottles of water. I know that we can find ways to recycle. We can use our imagination with this, or have filters on the tap at home, as I have. And we say to ourselves, my primary drink is water. This is the best for the being, and it tastes fabulous. And all other drinks, you know, I go for my, make my pilgrimage most days of the week to the secular church, which that means the local coffee shop for Holy Communion, which means oat latte. And I go there, but primary drinking, water. I just wish to encourage it. I don't have the authoritarianist position to be a dictator. I would accept the job if I was given it, with no question, and implement some of these things. However, with the donations. George kindly mentioned to you, and it is a precious service that Sangha Live offered, and all credit to Martin and the team of putting all of this together. And with this, I kind of have realized now with Zoom, because I'm having to organize so much thing, just how much work goes into all of this Zooming around the world there. So I get a sense with the good team at Sangha Live, their output, and all, of course, the costs, as George reminded us as well. And of course, I'm going to say, and the same for Christopher too, with the costs. So your kindness and generosity, what it does, it gives real support. I mean, really support. Without it, without the donations called dana, D-A-N-A in the tradition, it would have to be payment for services model. But this is the heart model. This is the trust model. And Sangha Live and elsewhere, that model is still alive and well. And we are inspired, in fact, by many Buddhist monasteries through what they're dana, or allowing us to come and stay. And with the model, your presence and your act of the giving not only ensures this current one can take place, that's i.e. with Christopher and the team, but also it gives the real support to the next teacher and the next meetings and Sangha offerings that are going on. And it just rolls on in a really precious way. And we all have our expenses. Of course we do, like life costs. And my precious teenage granddaughter, that I add here, she lives with me, lives in the loft, in the room, in the loft, which got converted some years ago. So since the beginning of last September, when the new school year started, she moved in with me there, and I've got a new role in life. I call myself a single grandparent. That's my new job title there. And you may be wondering, why isn't she with her mum? So basically they live, must be 350 kilometers away. She was subject to very intense bullying. She was picked on, and it wasn't even safe for her on the streets either, with the threats. So family discussion, and here she is. And of course, I'm very happy to have Danae, my granddaughter, it's an American Indian word, to be here. And again, your kindness and support enables the support for all of this, and for Nishauna, my daughter, her mindfulness projects, and much, much more. So the Sangha Live give me a percentage, around a third, and two thirds, because there's a lot more of them needing support. And I just want to express for all of those you give, both in past and in present, one big thank you. Really, thank you. Much, much appreciated. We're very, very grateful. And it's still a joy to live this way after some 50 years of this style. All right. So, it's a Q&A time. I've got my glasses here. I've got the water. And if they're easy questions, I'll answer, and I'll avoid the hard ones. All right. So the questions can be spoken, of course. George is here. He will connect you. And at the moment, what I'm seeing on the screen on the right-hand side is kind words, which I'm happy to stay with.
Right. You can see the ask a question box. There's
oh yes, I forgot. Yes, thanks, George. I should know by now, shouldn't I? Okay. How can mindfulness So good questions already. Nice. Never sit. I would have been scrolling up and down for eternity on that right side. I said to George before we come on, George, don't hesitate, interrupt, keep me on the ball. How can mindfulness help with obsessive thoughts? All right. If the thoughts are obsessive, that means rather relentless. Frankly, give up the idea you can watch them. Asking too much. And if you've got the hand, you can see my hand here, got the hand like this, how can you watch, see the lines of the hand? They're too close to consciousness. They're too close to the mindfulness. So if there is the space to observe, if one really can observe thought and see it as a thought, the obsessive factor is weak. They're not too obsessive. But plenty of times, really obsessive thinking is going over and over and over and over again, little variations, and then the thought comes in, oh, I shouldn't be obsessive. I should be more mindful of it. That is in the feature of obsessive thinking. It's part of the thinking, so it doesn't have any power to bring about change. And that does tend to happen in the streams of such thinking. So, firstly, one's got to find ways to interrupt it. If being mindful and sitting on your ass is not interrupting it, and it may not be, then you don't do that. It's that simple. And therefore, to interrupt it's going to be something a bit more vital, invigorating. You dance. You go for a long, long walk. You keep your eyes and ears open so that you really absorb, alone you go. You're really absorbing what you see and hear. You walk around your streets. If you live in the city, you walk around the park. You walk around the countryside. You look and you hear. You look and you see. Keep walking and walking. That's your priority. And that will contribute to breaking the obsessive thinking. You look and say, okay, what's the primary story in the thinking? What are you going on about? What are you rambling on about in the mind, whatever it might be? And say, okay, that zone, shall we call it, that deep, dark corner of my mind keeps interrupting, it keeps disturbing myself. What am I saying with these obsessive thoughts? There's going to be a lot of repetitive one-liners in it. It has to be. You want to write them down and you want to say to yourself, I'm going to, it's a determination. See if I can catch the thought as early as possible before you get lost in them. If you get lost in them, you move, you walk, you dance, you take the long walk, you do some yoga, whatever. You keep breaking the energy which is going into the thinking. You have to do it every day until you've broken it. And it might provide in the movement of that some insight into the what you're obsessing about. You may be able to look at the issue, including obsessive thinking, more clearly to understand it. And then you're out of it. The story is it's over. Energy, movement of the energy as early, as quickly as possible is a good, healthy start. So you are saying, next question, we have to go through difficult, oh, just a minute, just drop down one here, but I'm going to go back up to where I was. You're saying that we have to go through difficult times to develop and appreciate the value of life. No, I'm not saying that, but I can understand why you might think that. If you have gone through multiple abusive and traumatic situations in life and healing is hard, how do you deal with the feelings of resentment and anger? Hope this question is not too hard. No, not yet. I know you're not a psychologist, Yes, I am. But the Buddha's teachings are a huge focus on the condition of the mind. So I'm a Buddha psychologist, necessarily. But I want a Buddhist perspective. Okay, it's really good, points there. Nobody has to go through a difficult time. If there is wisdom and clarity in our life and quiet enjoyment of our life, and we're kind of quietly in touch, I don't see why we have to go through a difficult time. And there are people who, and I include myself, in fact, in this, can't think of anything in my entire life which I regarded as abusive or traumatic, to use the good person's words, and therefore not left with any resentment or anger. I'm not boasting, I'm just saying this is how it is for Christopher, and knowing plenty of people, I know others who would say exactly the same as I am saying. So just make that first point. There are people who, as you point out, go through multiple abusive and traumatic situations. My daughter and I, we're working with healing, we're working with domestic violence situations, family situations, social violence situations. We know our children are Anglo-Caribbean. We know about the impact on their lives and the family life, as well as many other families. And with that, as you say, there can be these variety of abusive situations. And as already said to you with the talk a couple of times there, we are not here to rely upon our own resources to try to resolve everything. It's not in the Buddha Dharma, not in the teaching. It is to repeat, it's taking refuge in the Sangha. The Sangha may be the psychotherapist, the psychologist, the counselor, the wise soul, the group that you feel you can open up to and share with and learn from. This is the Sangha. Caring men and women on this earth, giving support to each other. Coming to the question of resentment and anger, we may have suffered and had to endure a great deal from the past, near and distant. It's not unsurprising that the outcome of it is this anger towards the past. Sometimes in the spiritual religious world, which is, I think, can be a problem, including the Buddhist world, that there's a kind of view, I should be forgiving. I should let go. I should show him, her, them more compassion. This is a 180 degree turnaround. There are not many hearts that can do that. So there's no anticipation or expectation that's how I should be. However, we are still giving authority to the abuser with our anger, because we're burning up inside. And with our resentment, we're burning up inside. So the teachings are an exploration in the dynamic, painful start, painful consequence there. Is there a way, without feeling I should be loving, should be kind, should be compassionate, should be forgiving, having none of that baggage there, and to be able to look at and find enough steadiness there, which we can look at that and find the equanimity, the presence and the steadiness, so there is no denial, but it's lost its grip. It is a big undertaking, I agree. It's a tough one, I agree. And it might require a good sharing and dynamic with another there, but it's to find the steadiness and be able to look at that for what it is. It happened in the past. It's horrendous it happened. But you're clear about it happening in the past and just beginning to sense a little bit of space. And there may be a moment or two when you look at the past and you know it's not got the grip on you. You just know it because you can feel enough calm of the being and that you wish to nourish. And then it has no authority over your existence. That can happen sometimes immediately, very quickly, sometimes. Or sometimes it's very slow and very gradual. But stay with it and keep the practice for exploration of it. And remember, life is also outside of that dynamic. And all those moments are really, really important.
Christopher, if you don't mind barging in again, I have one participant that would like to come on screen, if it's okay with you.
Yes, exactly. So shall I, with the question answer, just click on the X in the corner so I can see the person?
No? She should be coming right away. She's just
expecting. Okay. Invitation.
Hello.
All right. I'm just going to click on this. Then I can see the person. All right. Yes, please. Yes.
Thank you. I wanted to ask about suffering. Well, suffering from losing people dying. I've experienced so many deaths in my life, and they seem to keep occurring. And of course, that's inevitable. But I have a difficulty in with the sadness that it keeps mounting up, and then it's difficult to let go. And so and in terms of like psychotherapy, it's considered complicated grief, I guess, complicated by the fact that I keep losing people, so it's sort of the effect is greater. So I'm just I'm trying to work on equanimity and all the Brahma Viharas, but I still am struggling with the grief part of it.
Yes. So I agree. In the relationship to past and death, and as you just mentioned a few moments ago, as we get into the winter of the life, we will know about, regularly, and hear about loved ones who we've laughed with and talked with and cried with and spent time with, and time is gone. They're gone. They're gone from this world. The response of sadness is an expression of empathy, which is natural, organic, healthy for a human being in relationship to loss and death. The teachings are never about getting rid of sadness, just not in the teaching at all, anywhere. Where the vigilance has to come in, and it's in two expressions from what you just said, one is where there is a certain regularity of sadness, frequency of death in this case, the sadness of the loss of one can leave a small or big residue of feeling. That then gains a bit of a momentum, so then it kind of lands on the next loss. So as you point out, it slowly begins to build. So one begins to feel in the heart more weight of sadness. And not unusual. The second aspect, I'll touch upon it in a moment. The second aspect to this is there is sadness. And the teachings are, as I mentioned, acknowledging the important place of sadness It's not put into the suffering box there. And when sadness becomes grief, I'm now speaking strictly Dharma language with its precision. Grief is sadness intensified with wanting. Wanting that it didn't happen. Wanting I'm left alone. Wanting it's unfair. All manner of wanting can take place. Quite often it might be in the name of the person's life, whatever their age has gone. But sometimes it's not really about the person, it's really actually about oneself. One's not grieving for the other, one is grieving for what I lost. What now I don't have him in my life, I don't have her in my life. And, but actually that self and wanting puts wood on the heat fire of the sadness. Going to take a bit of mindfulness here, a bit of awareness. And what I mean by that is, sadness will come to you in the moments and times when it's not pressing on you. And there will be times, you know, whatever it might be, you might be watching television, you might be in the shop doing shop, you might be doing a bit of gardening, having a conversation with a friend. When it's not pressing on you, it will require lots of recognition, appreciation for these moments, for these times, so that your recovery brings you back into those times more easily. And to really catch, as I mentioned a moment ago, when the sadness is intensifying, the wanting will be part of it. And one expression of it is, I wanting it to stop. It's a pressure. And it's a pressure not born out of awareness, it's a pressure born out of the sadness. It's a statement of coming out of the sadness. And the more we want, the more pressure and the more sad we feel. We're putting wood on the fire with no intention. So the moments outside of that world called sadness, loss, sadness, sometimes grief, loss, strong sadness, sometimes grief, sometimes out of that world will matter a great deal. You've got to keep your eyes and ears open. Let light and sound in. Really experience the moments of the day as part of your preparation for the sadness which is present and find space around it. And that's your best preparation if another sadness comes along.
Thank you. Beautiful, thank wise you. Words. Thank you so much.
All right, then. Thank you. Right. Another sip of the. How are we doing? Oh my gosh, it's 8:29 here. All right. Honey, the number of people who are present is pretty well the same number as the last couple of times. It makes me smile. I know it's not all the same people. All right. What? What's a clear experience? Okay, I'll just read it out. It's not so much a question, it's a statement. It's a good one there. And then I'll just try and... What a clear expression of what we face when we allow ourselves to be vulnerable enough to engage in relationships with someone and then to accept what can happen to that experience. This is useful in living out the relationships in which I find myself. Yeah. There's about an allowance of ourselves to really... work with these situations there, and thank you for the good reminder. So can you please say more about what taking refuge is? For instance, how do we really connect with Sangha, especially if you have social anxiety? Yeah, Sangha. in a can be one other. It is the presence of the other in our life with whom we have a connection and a sense of trust, who we feel we can talk with and also we can listen to. And the confirmation is it's supportive and it might just be you and one other. With social anxiety, which is very, very common there. This is an area for working with. And that means it's a development in which that experience is shared with another and others. And it might be very slow and step by step. And what I mean by that is you might go from one person and then you go to two people and you explore that and you share that and you're open. The person or persons know you have social. Then you go to three people. And that gradual step by step begins to open up and the social anxiety will go down. It's only really in the application of entering into the lion's den that these things get resolved. And that will need some support from friend or friends. And most people are very happy to give support for that. All right, last question here, because it's now 1 hour and 31 minutes. Question for Christopher or others. Do you know the name of the English Dharma teacher who leads retreats at the International Meditation Center, now Maitreya Project in Bodh Gaya, at the same time in 1995? Yes, but don't tell me. Michael, oh gosh, it's a long time ago. It might come to me, so send me an email and I'll dig it out. Yeah, it's Michael Kay. That part, you're right. He's still around, by the way, and a year or two, at least, as far as I know, a year or two ago, but I can't think of the name. So let's just finish at this time and have our quiet minute together. The Sangha of women and men spending time together, giving each other support, exploring the experience of this human world. May all beings find ways to meet the fullness of life. May all beings emerge out of the painful impacts of the past. May all beings live with love and liberation. Thank you very much for your kind contributions. Thank you, Sangha Live. Thank you for lending an ear.